get yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a-screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to continue on our recent themes, including some follow-up information on the U.S. economy and the first quarter GDP and the first month of the second quarter here, April. What is it beginning to look like? And then I want to talk, as I promised last week, about a topic in Europe here, and that is exit. Not just Greece's potential exit from the Eurozone, but Britain, UK's now rising possibility of exit from the European Union. Okay, we got a Brexit, as they call it, B-R-E-X-I-T, from the right. In other words, the conservative Tory party recently won a major re-election here. Cameron is prime minister now. The topic of Brexit, as they call it, Britain exit from the EU, is a very hot topic on the agenda. What does it mean? And then we have perhaps a exit from stage left. You know, if Brexit, Britain, Tories, Conservative, is a possibility of exit from stage right, exit from stage left with Greece. And those negotiations continue to intensify and become increasingly difficult in Greece. And the prospect of a default and or exit is increasingly on the agenda there, more likely a default. Although I don't think they will default, and I don't think Greece's exit is on the immediate agenda, but I believe it is more and could be on an intermediate agenda. They have to go through the whole issue of a default or not default, and we'll talk about that. And then exit comes up as a possibility here. Okay, so we will talk about the U.S. economy, and then we'll talk about the British exit, Brexit, whatever you want to call it, and then Greece and Grexit. Okay, let's start with the U.S. here, right, as we promised last week. Once again, U.S. First quarter GDP, the first GDP revision, first report came out with a 0.2% economic growth in the first quarter. But absolute consensus now is that that is going to be revised on May 29th here when we get the first revision. And now it's just a question of how negative the first quarter was. And estimates vary from a negative 0.3% decline in GDP, not a positive 0.2, to a negative 0.7% decline. Could be even worse, I think. Okay, so what's going on here? Why is it actually looking worse when they get more data now about the first quarter than the original report? Well, there were three major areas that contributed to this collapse of GDP, U.S. GDP, now negative in the first quarter of this year. By the way, as I've said, this is the fourth time in 4 years that we've had a collapse of U.S. GDP, and it always seems to come in the winter. You know, and questions are being raised now. Well, you know, maybe it's not... It's not the weather. Maybe it has something to do with cycles here of consumer and business spending in an economy that can't really gain traction and loses its momentum in the winter. Or some are even saying, maybe there's something wrong with the statistics, you know? Is this just a coincidence that for 4 years in a row, the collapse has always been in the fourth quarter or first quarter of the year? You watch. I predict they're going to use that possible explanation as a way of going in this summer and revising once again how they calculate GDP to minimize the seasonal adjustment statistical corrections that they make. They'll do something, smooth it out, whatever, to make the winter statistically appear better than it actually is. And they'll blame the fact that we've had four years in a row here where the winter is noticeably worse. And the argument is, oh, they're not making enough seasonal adjustment, so they'll have to adjust more, which will mean it will show that U.S. GDP is actually higher than it actually is. You know, I mean, this is not raw data, folks. This is all statistics. This is all, you get raw data, and you do this and that statistical operation on it, you know, and if you've got a significant number of such operations, you know, you can fudge things and make it look like, it's something other than it is not. They've been doing this with job numbers for quite some time, and, of course, inflation numbers as well, to smooth it out. So I predict that now in this summer, when the Commerce Department does its annual adjustments of how it estimates GDP, they'll tweak the seasonal adjustments to make the winter quarters look better than they actually have been. Okay, so we'll watch that one closely, just as they did in 2013. As I've said on numerous occasions, they redefined GDP to include items that were intangible and were expenses like R&D. Now they count them as GDP, which before they were just business expenses. And they got $500 billion a year more GDP out of that adjustment. And they'll look to do this again in another way. So, you know, these numbers are becoming increasingly unreliable, I think, in the long run here. But anyway, we'll look at that and, keep in mind it comes on top of 2 years ago, another major adjustment that boosted GDP numbers by 0.3% at least. So any of the numbers you see coming out, GDP, just subtract 0.3% more, and that'll get you closer to what's actually happening. So, you know, this 0.2% positive growth first quarter is really already negative 0.1. And if they adjust it down further, we could have as much as a 1% drop in GDP. Now, you know, they've been making this argument, oh, it's either the weather, it's the weather that's the problem, or they've thrown in another little twist here in first quarter by saying, you know, it's not just the weather, it was the work stoppage on the ports on the West Coast. You know, Longshore Union here had a dispute with the shipping employers, and the shipping employers locked them out pretty much, just pretty much said, okay, you know, we're gonna shut down some of the operations. And the slowdown by the union and all that slowed down the shipment of goods from Asia. And that apparently contributed to some extent, so the argument goes. But, you know, if you really look at first quarter GDP, as I said in a previous show here, a big factor was the collapse of U.S. exports to the rest of the world and a decline in the cost of imports, particularly the cost of oil imports. All that whacked the trade factor, whacked 1.25% off of GDP. And that was significantly responsible for why the first quarter GDP flattened out and now will actually turn negative. That was a big factor. But there were other factors as well, as I pointed out before. And, that includes the decline in ACA, in other words, Affordable Care Act consumer spending that was boosted last year for the first time as people had a first full year of sign-ups, you know, and that disappeared pretty much. Everyone signed up that they were going to. And then we had the boom in the oil shale area production, industrial production, and transport related to that as this global fight between OPEC, led by the Saudis, to try to harm and reduce the influence of U.S. oil shale, oil gas shale producers here who were really cutting into them long run. There's a fight between capitalists going on here. You know, U.S. Shale oil capitalists and this whole shale oil revolution against the you know, the old liners, OPEC, with their crude production here. They're in an intercapitalist battle here, and that has a lot to do with the collapse of the global oil price, which began last summer, which has resulted in a sharp decline now because there's a glut of oil and shale oil drilling and production and transport and so on and so forth. I mean, it's so significant going on, particularly in certain regions of the country, you know, like North Dakota and Texas and Oklahoma, a few other places where all the shale drilling is going on. It's so significant that it looks like we're running at a loss of 200,000 jobs in that oil patch this year projected. We've already, in the first quarter, lost 50,000 jobs. So it's really contracting. All right, so that had an effect on the decline. Of course, that's not a weather-related factor, is it? You know, weather doesn't affect drilling. Those were two reasons that were recognized. But now, after the first quarter, other factors are beginning to appear here, and that is the assumption in the first GDP report that business inventory investment was pretty robust. Well, it wasn't so robust, right? As we will talk about here shortly. Business inventories were grossly overestimated, and therefore its contribution to first quarter GDP was overestimated. And that's going to play a big role. The new numbers, which were much weaker, are going to play a bigger role here in this revision on May 29th, the first quarter GDP. You know, and that follows what I've been saying has been occurring here. It's not the weather. It's not the statistical manipulation and errors in the winter responsible for these contractions. It's in the summer months, business pumps up inventories in expectation of the consumer actually now finally taking off and spending in the fourth quarter and the holidays. And then that spending does not materialize, so business then has to, right after the poor holiday spending seasons, has to contract those inventories, and that has a big effect on first quarter GDP. Right? And we see that happen time and time again, business anticipating that there will be a consumer spending takeoff that does not materialize. Now, last summer, the expectation of such a consumer spending was particularly strong since oil and gas prices, gasoline prices, were beginning to fall. So business said, oh, this time consumers are really going to take off in the holidays because they're going to have all that extra money from lower gas prices that they will spend. Well, I predicted way back in the fall that, no, they're not going to spend it. They're going to save it, and they're going to pay down their debts with it. You know, it's not going to result in additional spending. And voila, it did not. Now everybody is admitting, the oil price, gasoline price decline didn't have the positive effect that they all were going to say it was going to have. But anticipation of that, the business built up its inventories last summer, exceptionally large. That had a lot to do with the 5% GDP growth in last summer, third quarter. But again, it did not materialize in consumer spending. Retail spending was December through February, December last year through February, was quite poor. And then, of course, now we see that businesses cut back on inventories here in the first quarter. So when this revision comes out May 29th, we'll see a big contraction in inventories because the assumption was, in the original numbers, that inventories contributed 0.74 positive to GDP, 0.74 positive growth. Actually, it wasn't. It was probably almost nothing. So that's where the big adjustment's going to be in the inventory side here. Okay, so, you know, let's talk about economists. You know, they had predicted a big, almost 3%, 2.5% growth for the first quarter. So they were way off, right? Way off. 62 economists who were surveyed, you know, got it totally wrong, right? And those same economists are now saying the second quarter U.S. GDP will bounce back at 2.8%. Okay? I mean, they totally missed the first quarter, but now they're saying it's going to be bouncing back, you know, snap back 2.8%. I don't know what this smoking stinkweed maybe, right? With these guys, you know, they get paid all this money for forecasting errors. And they say, well, okay, why are we going to have this recovery of 2.8%? Well, first of all, it's U.S. exports are going to bounce back, right? We're going to get this full rapid recovery of exports that we had a problem with in the first quarter. You know, well, who's going to buy all these exports, these U.S. exports? You know, they're saying because the dollar is going to decline now. See, that was one of the real problems why U.S. exports were doing so poorly. The dollar was rising. The Federal Reserve was saying, oh, we're gonna raise interest rates, which causes the dollar to rise, right? And then the Europeans were doing their QE and driving their euro down, which caused the dollar to rise. And the Japanese were doing the same with QE, driving the yen down, and the dollar was rising, right? And collapsing oil prices raises the dollar. Well, now they're saying that this is all over. No, and now the dollar is going to rapidly decline, and exports are going to come back, you know, strongly, like they did, you know, in the first half of 2014 here. So this big drag, this 1.25% drag on first quarter GDP is going to be gone. But who's going to buy the exports, right? Well, is China going to buy the exports? Well, China's slowing, continuing progressively, steadily to slow. You know, their real economy probably is growing no more than 5%, not the 7%, they say. Okay. The Eurozone, are they going to pick up buying the stuff? Well, you know, their euro is rising. So, you know, they're not going to sell as much imports to the U.S., right? And the U.S., you know, is not going to buy, sell exports, you know, to the Eurozone. How about the emerging markets? Oh, well, they're steadily, slowly declining. Japan, they're still in the funk, right? So I don't know who's going to buy all these U.S. exports. You know, the global economy is steadily slowing, and, you know, not directly, you know, some months a little bit, some months back. But, you know, the long-term trend is very clear. So I don't see where this big reversal and U.S. exports is going to drive us back up to the 2.8% that the economists are forecasting here. Also, this 2.8% optimistic forecast for the second quarter assumes that consumers will start spending again big time in the second quarter. Well, some cold water was just thrown on that with April retail sales. Just came out here this past week, and guess what? Zero growth in April. Zero compared to like 5% last summer. Retail sales have flattened out, totally flattened out. And, you know, it's significant because the flattening out in retail sales, it has to do with an interesting decline in auto sales. Auto sales declined, and so did other big-ticket purchases, furniture, appliances, electronics. You know, in the April flat, no growth comes after a March growth of only 1.3% and a slow and poor performance for retail sales between December and February. So the longer-term trend is retail sales are slowing. You know, the retail sales data this whole trend since December, getting worse, getting worse, disproves two things. One, this nonsense forecast that declining gasoline prices at the pump will lead to more consumption. Well, we talked about that, right? Well, very clearly, the decline of retail sales debunks that notion. But, you know, it also debunks the notion that bad weather caused the first quarter drop in U.S. GDP. Did we have bad weather in April? You know, March, you could argue, you know, beginning of March, end of March, it was 1.3% growth, you know, like 25% of what it was last summer. And now, of course, you know, we got zero. Bad weather? Oh, come on, you know. Well, what are the economists saying about that? Well, they're saying that, the bad weather in the winter caused certain bad habits by consumers, and they're just sort of continuing that bad habit of not buying in bad weather, even though the weather has turned good. So, you know, we go from a bad weather metaphor to a bad habit metaphor. All this is bad economics and bad forecasting. That's all. Because if you look at retail sales over the past year, take the whole year, even with this boost last summer, it's less than 1% growth. Less than 1%. The consumer is not opening his wallet long term. Well, why? Because there's no income growth, stupid. You know, that's the real problem. Oh, they say, we have a 2% growth in wages. Well, what's contained in their definition of wages? Well, it includes the salary and salary increases of the top 10% and CEOs and so forth. That's considered wages. In other words, all this wage growth is concentrated at the top. Also, you got to understand that wages, as they are defined in the U.S., include 65% of the profits, business income, of small businesses. Of proprietors. 65% of their profits are considered wages. Oh, okay, so businesses, even small businesses, are doing okay, and the top 10%, you know, professionals and so forth, the CEOs, managers, they're doing okay, they're getting the increases, and it comes out to be 2%, but, you know, if you factor those out, and it was just us average wage earners at the median level, we would be going backwards. You see how you can sort of hide and obfuscate the real data for hundreds of millions of people if you just throw in those who are doing well at the top. Makes it look better than it is. But, you know, the problem is retail sales are bought by everybody, and they're going nowhere except south, right? And that's because there's not enough income. Oh, and they say, well, we're creating all these jobs. Yeah, at what rate of pay? These are essentially jobs that are very low paid, or contingent jobs, part-time temp paid, which are very low paid, okay? And, people in part-time temp jobs don't have benefits and no job security, and that means they're going to watch their spending, even though they get a job, very closely, right? Okay, so the consumer is not really coming back. Sorry, that's not really happening. Regardless of all you bad weather, bad habit, bad forecast economists say about it. All right, so moving on, business inventories, as I said, business inventories are actually much worse than reported. Retail sales looks bad. Okay, and the oil shale is in a funk here in terms of jobs and investment and production and so forth, right? I don't see where this 2.8% is coming from. I really don't. Right? Longer term, if you look at the U.S. economy, there's a real problem here in the U.S. economy, and that is there just isn't much real investment going on. Okay? If you look at the investment figures, net of depreciation, right? Listen to this. Look, between 2006 and 2014, net private domestic investment, that is real investment, you know, in plants and in structures, business structures, equipment, and so forth, that creates real jobs. I'm not talking about, you know, restaurant bartending jobs. I'm talking about real jobs here. Have only grown 3.9% over the last 8 years. Think about that, 3.9%. That's less than 0.5% per year. In 2006, U.S. net private domestic investment, $860 billion. In 2014, last year, $524 billion. What is going on here? Well, there's no real investment creating real jobs. That's what's going on. Therefore, you don't have much real income growth. And if you don't have real income growth from real jobs, you don't get real retail sales and real consumption. You know, consumption is not as good an indicator as retail sales. Retail sales are largest percentage of consumption. Consumption is like 66% of the U.S. economy. But consumption is biased by housing purchases, most of which are going on by institutional investors and foreign investors and foreigners paying cash for homes and, you know, private equity firms buying up large blocks of cheap houses here and renting them out and making money. So, you know, you got to back that out to get a clearer picture of what the U.S. consumer is doing. I mean, there's only sales going on largely in housing at the high end, mid to high end. It's not going on as in a healthy sense anymore. Well, you know, this lack of real investment, which I talk about in detail, by the way, in my new book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, coming out in September. If you want more details on that, go to my website, Kyklos Productions, KYKLOSProductions.com, and go to the book tab, and you can you know, get a look at what the book's going to be about there. But the lack of real investment means that productivity is declining. And you know what? It is. If you look at productivity growth, which is a sign of real investment, and therefore real job and income growth, between 1948 and 1973, it grew in the U.S. at an average of 3.2%, okay, consistently, which is a pretty good, you know, decent productivity growth rate. Between 1995 and 2010, it grew at 2.6%. Now, keep in mind, you know, this 1995 to 99 is the dot-com boom, right, where we had the last hurrah of U.S. investment growth. So that 2.6%, you know, 1995 to 2010, lower than the historical average, but not that much lower. Okay, but when you look at the numbers since then, look at the numbers for 2005 to 14. U.S. productivity growth only 1.5%. That was less than half of historical normal. And if you look at 2011 to 14, productivity, annual productivity growth of only 0.4% annually. Hardly any productivity growth at all. Why? Because we had hardly any real investment at all. Hardly real investment. As one economist said, Alan Blinder, who is, you know, one of the gurus, writes all the time in the Wall Street Journal, considers himself a sort of a conservative Keynesian. You know, he's mainstream. You know, he's really mainstream. He says, when he looks at these numbers on productivity, he says, quote, scary. Scary. We don't know why. The scary thing is we don't know why productivity is so low. And then elsewhere in his article, he says, well, weak investment can account for 70% of it, perhaps. Well, wait a minute, Alan, you say you don't know why, and then you say investment is the responsible for the weak productivity growth? Yeah, okay. Make up your mind. Well, it's pretty clear. And it's not just business investment, but gross government investment down 13% since 2007. In other words, on infrastructure and so on and so forth. Yeah, nothing's going on the government side or private side in terms of real investment. That's why we're not creating real jobs. And all we can create is low-pay service jobs, often not even at 40 hours per week. And no wonder income's not growing. Well, it's not growing for wage earners. You know, let's clarify that. Because it's growing by leaps and bounds for people with capital incomes. You know, stock market's up 300%. You know, bond market's up, you know. As I talked about previously, $5 trillion since 2009 given in stock buybacks and dividend payouts to wealthy stock and bond investors in the U.S. just for the largest 500 companies, $5 trillion. Well, someone made a lot of money. In the meantime, you know, all of us are getting lower wages and cheaper jobs with no benefits. Well, and then they wonder, why there's income inequality? Well, it's not simply that wages aren't growing. It's because the other guys with their capital incomes are raking it in. We got two, on the bottom end and the top end, and that's just squeezing. Well, not squeezing, but stretching out, you know, the income inequality gap. And then they wonder why we don't have retail sales. This stuff isn't rocket science, you know. And it just amazes me, continues to amaze me, how professional economists, you know, can be so dumb. Well, maybe they're not so dumb. Maybe they know the facts. They just paid the lie. Right? Or, you know, maybe it's a combination of both. I think maybe it's a combination of both. Some of them know better, like Alan Blinder, you know. But, if you really point the finger at corporate America, you won't get the right editorials in the Wall Street Journal. They'll cut you out immediately. And even folks like Paul Krugman, you know, who raises a lot of facts, important arguments and everything, when it comes to, who's responsible for this? Well, pretty short on that answer. Just the corporations. Okay, so now we're going to move from the U.S. to Europe. Okay, Brexit and Grexit. B-R-E-X-I-T, you know, like exit and B-R Britain and G-R Greece exit. That's what that refers to. What's going on? What's going on in Europe? Is the economy in Europe that's been in a funk for a long time, in and out of recessions, growth barely at the, you know, above the zero stagnation rate here. What's going to happen over there? Well, things are getting more and more unstable, right? We see more and more parties rising in Europe, new parties challenging the corporate banker status quo, right? Some would call that neoliberalism, in Europe. You know, Syriza in Greece, Podemos on the verge in Spain, right? The National Front, the right wing. And see, it doesn't matter if it's right or left. What's happening in Europe is that people are running out of patience after 6 years and no growth. The political system's beginning to fracture. But it's fracturing in the middle, you see. If you're a party, a classical social democratic party, and you're in the middle, you're in trouble. You're in trouble in England because it's polarizing, right? It's the social democratic parties that are getting wiped out, you know, who claim that they're progressive, who claim even that they're socialists sometimes. It's a strange word in England, socialism, you know. Doesn't really mean what it says, in the same social democratic parties everywhere. They're really center-right parties. You know, they have this ideology of center-left, progressive-left, social democracy, but their policies are clearly center-right. You know, there haven't been any social democratic parties in Europe for decades now, just as there hasn't been a democratic party in this country since the 1980s. It's been totally transformed. Okay. Well, let's talk about Brexit. David Cameron, Prime Minister of the UK, they had an election in the UK here a couple of weeks ago, beginning of May, and he won overwhelmingly, once again. The Conservatives, they call them Tories, are in control, and they don't even need a minority government. They have enough in the Parliament to form their own government, and they have, right? Now, a part of Cameron's centerpiece, of Cameron's election campaign, was that we will put a vote to the British people whether they want to stay in the European Union. I promise you that, you know, running my campaign, we're going to vote on whether we stay in the European Union, the EU. A very clever political move, you know, because with the decline and the stagnant lack of growth in the economies in the UK and elsewhere in Europe, you know, people are getting antsy, and at the same time, they're cleverly immigrants are being blamed for it, right? The press and clever politicians and center and right are blaming the immigrants for it. The immigrants are the cause of this. You see, if you're in the European Union, part of the European Union treaty is that workers can move anywhere, capital can move anywhere, so workers can move anywhere within the EU. There has been a significant movement of immigrant labor, particularly from Eastern Europe countries, into Britain. Britain and Ireland, places like that, right? France, etc. So movement of immigrants is an issue, but they're being blamed for the lack of real growth and real recovery. Now, that's common. You know, in this country, we used to, you know, blame immigrants and of all kinds for keeping wages down, and we still do that, don't we? Yes. So they do that over there too. But the point is, in his election campaign, he promised to do something about this. Have a vote to pull out of the EU if necessary. And he has now, after he's won, has to have that vote. By the way, I predicted that Britain would leave the EU 2 years ago. In my July 2013 article in Z Magazine called Predicting the U.S. and Global Economy, 2013-14, I said, quote, more economies in the Eurozone will slip into recession, and the U.K. will vote to leave the European Union. That was 2 years ago. One of my 15 predictions at the time. Okay, so now that Cameron has won, he has to vote on that. When are they going to vote on it? Well, technically, they don't have to vote on it until 2017, but I predicted they'll have the vote in 2016, next year. Okay, I will explain briefly why that is. You know, so we have a possible exit from the right. Tories, conservatives here from the Eurozone, just as we, there's talk about Greek exiting from the Eurozone itself, quote, from the left, if you consider Syriza the leading party there now, leftist. It's very interesting that Cameron, in his election campaign, made this an issue. Smart. He was smart because in Britain, there is a party called UKIP, UKIP, which has as its primary, one of the primary platform proposals is to stop immigration into Europe. So by moving to the right on this issue, Cameron cleverly outflanked the UKIP. You got Scotland. And the Scottish National Party, the SNP, which swept all of the seats in British Parliament, almost every single seat, I think there was a few exceptions, in Scotland. Okay, so the SNP wants to, they just had this vote that they, got cheated on, I think, to Scotland and break off from Britain, from the UK, right? Barely lost it. So the Scottish MPs now are a real bloc. They're almost independent. And it's just a matter of time before Scotland actually does have another vote and become independent. And it's to the interest of the SNP to have Britain leave the EU, right? To break off from the EU. It makes the likelihood of Scotland justifying Scotland breaking off from the UK. And if they take that referendum vote, then that may precipitate another early vote by Scotland and the SNP now to separate themselves from the UK. Okay, so Cameron promised to hold a referendum, was clever, to outflank both the UKIP and the SNP on this issue. Now, contrast this with the British Labour Party that got swamped, and the Liberal Party, another smaller middle-of-the-road party there in the UK that almost disappeared. Both of them are pro, let's stay within the EU. You know, I mean, incompetent. British Labour Party's campaign was truly incompetent here. They totally ignored this issue that Cameron cleverly identified. They underestimated the anti-immigration vote and sentiment here, right? And the Labour Party gets whacked. It loses seats to the SNP, and it loses seats to the Tories. And the Liberal Party gets totally wiped out. The center is getting wiped out, in other words. The Labour Party occupies a more center position in the UK with the Tories on the right, just like the Democratic Party does here with the Republicans on the right. Okay, long term, I think the political party alignments are in favor of UK leaving the EU. But, below the level of the parties, you have, the class alignments here as well. And British finance capital wants to leave the EU. The EU is imposing, Germany, France, and so forth, stronger rules on banking. In Britain, the City of London banking establishment, as they call it, is kind of like Wild West capital, banking capital. And they don't want to be regulated. And they're, indicating all kinds of threats if there's further regulation. In fact, two of the British banks, HSBC and Standard Charter, have raised the possibility they may move out of London to Asia. Cameron's big friends with the big banks there. He'll do everything to protect them. And if they want out, in order to keep Wild West banking in London, they want out from the regulations before they happen. He'll do that. Okay. Other sectors of UK capital also want out. Some want to stay in, but some want to stay out. Interesting, just yesterday, the Bank of England Governor Mark Carney publicly, in an interview with the BBC, said, we got to have a vote on this sooner, not later. Not 2017 is too late. We got to have a vote on this in 2016. That's why they'll have a vote in 2016. He's reflecting the banking interests. Because if they don't have a serious, an early vote, all this uncertainty is going to affect British business. And if you look at the first quarter, British business grew, or the economy grew at only 0.3%. In other words, their previous growth of the last couple of years, as tepid as it was driven largely by foreign capital money flowing into the UK from outside Europe and outside Britain. This hot money flowing in, particularly into British real estate in southern England. That's what gave it a little bit of a boost, the economy. Kept it from falling into a third recession since 2008, barely, but that's dissipated now, you see. And they're going to have to revive the economy. They cannot let this vote go unrecorded here for two more years. So, it's going to be 2016. They've got to have the vote, too, before German and French national elections in 2016, right? So, there will be a vote, and I predict it'll be a vote, you know, within a year, 12, 15 months, right? In the interim, Cameron's saying, I'm going to go and negotiate a better deal with the Europeans here, right? Some exceptions to the treaty that formed the European Union won't happen, David, won't happen, right? The EU countries can't retreat on the things that they've got in their treaty without, you know, blowing up the entire treaty. So they won't retreat, and they won't retreat on bank regulation. Eastern Europe won't retreat on immigration. You know, Eastern Europe countries in the EU are, you know, want their populace that they can't provide jobs for to be able to migrate to, you know, France and UK and Ireland and other places and send the money home, right? The announcement here after his election by Cameron, you know, that, oh, we got to change the treaty, has provoked some interesting responses. Hungary has said, nope, immigration's a red line. We aren't going to cross that. And Poland says, nope, it's sacrosanct. Those are quotes, right? We're not going to do that. You know, if you look at the economy, the UK is less and less dependent on exports to Europe anyway. In 2007, 57% of its exports were to the EU, and now it's less than 50%. Conversely, the UK's exports to non-European EU countries has risen from 45% to over 50%. So the UK is changing and orienting to the rest of the world, particularly to China. You know, they want to develop these deep trade relationships with China. You know, big Chinese trade delegations have come to London in waves here and promised to buy up real estate and loan them money to regenerate their utilities and infrastructure and so forth. You know, so China and Asia is more important now. Then increasingly, I would say, growing. It's about 50-50 here, but it will grow far more important to England and Britain, so there's less need for them to stay in the EU. And there are, you know, finance capital and other capitalist interests saying, get out of it, and there are political parties that are out flanking Cameron and so forth. So there will be an election. There will be an election in 2016, I would say. And I think if they put the election to a vote today, you know, British people would vote to leave. It may be even more strongly oriented that if the British economy can't regenerate itself, right, between now and then. Okay, what about Grexit? What about the Greek exit, you know? We've been talking about this. I've been writing about this. Frequently, at least once a month in my published articles for Telesur Media in South America. You can read those on my website, or you can also read them on my blog, jackrasmus.com. Sort of like a running commentary since January on this Greek crisis here that's so important. Well, right now, they bought 2 months' time, the last 2 months here in early May. And now negotiations are going to get really intensive, and led by the Germans, they're not budging at all. In other words, they want Greece to adhere to the old arrangements. And Greece is saying, gee, we can't make payments. We're in, you know, perpetual depression this way. How can we pay you if we can't grow the economy? And we can't grow the economy because you say we got to do certain things in order to pay you. So they're in a death spiral. Greece is in a death spiral, and they know it. And they're trying to negotiate with the bankers and the finance ministers of Northern Europe who are calling the shots, and they're not getting anywhere. You know, the arrogant bankers, you know, the only thing more arrogant than a banker is an arrogant German banker, and they're saying no. You know, you just adhere to the old arrangement. That's it, right? Well, why are they so adamant about this? Because what they want Greece to do is labor market reform. That's what they really want. What is that? Oh, that's something that's a key policy objective of the corporate elites across Europe, labor market reform. That is, we want to reduce wages. We want to make it easier to fire full-time permanent workers, you know, which is kind of hard in some of these countries. We want to reduce pensions. You know, we think people are retiring too early and the pensions are too, too generous. And generally, you know, they want labor market flexibility, which means we want to cut this and that and, you know, make your job less secure and all kinds of stuff. You know, that's what labor market reform is. In other words, turn it into a U.S. kind of labor market. And by doing that, they will reduce wage costs. And by reducing wage costs, they will make the European exports more competitive, you see. This is the whole strategy. Grow Europe out of its funk through exports. And we do this by devaluating the euro with QE, which is happening. And we do it within euro by what's called internal devaluation, cut costs, which means labor costs, which means you need labor market reform. But the Greeks won't go along with this so far. And that's a non-starter for the bankers, the German bankers and the Dutch bankers and so forth. They're all calling the shots here in Northern Europe. You know, how did they get into this problem, we might ask, before we talk about Brexit? Well, you know, it goes back to the formation of the euro, which was fully implemented by 2002. When that happened, it was a real boon to German and Northern European economies because now they could export their goods to Southern Europe and the periphery of Europe, which there was a demand for those goods, because they had the same currency. You know, it just boosted the exports from the north of Europe to Southern Europe. Well, how did the Southern Europeans pay for it? Well, they paid for it because the Northern European bankers loaned them money to buy the Northern European exports. You see, it was a nice deal for the Germans and others in Northern Europe because they loaned the money, and then Greeks and Italy and all of them and Spain and Portugal had to repay the loans, okay, the interest on the loans, but the money that they loaned came right back to buy their exports. So they made money. The Germans and so forth made money on these exports, and then they made a nice continuing income stream paying the interest on the debt of those exports. In other words, the whole thing was set up and caused by the North. And yet the Germans and others, you know, they act, you know, moralistically, oh, you got to pay your bills, you know. Well, we set you guys up that way. And, you know, of course, everyone thought that the money would just keep flowing, you know, into Southern Europe to buy goods from Northern Europe, and the debts were built up. But then the crisis hit 2009-10, and you know, nobody could pay their debts. So the Germans, you know, the Northern Europeans, the Troika, this, you know, European Central Bank, the European Commission, you know, IMF, they all stepped in, and they said, okay, we have a crisis in 2010. We'll loan you some more money so you can keep paying the money that you owed us, that we loaned you before. But the original round of money and borrowing came from the private sector, private banks and so forth. The next round of bailouts came from investors and the government sectors in Northern Europe, loaning the money to Greece and, you know, the other countries, rolling over the old debts, right? And then there was another recession, the second recession in Europe in 2012, and, you know, once again, even though you rolled over the debt one time in 2010, they still couldn't pay it because now there's another recession. So here we come, you know, another IMF and all the guys, you know, the Troika swoop down and say, okay, we'll renegotiate again, give you some more money so you can keep paying the old. But you know what? In 2012, we want you to, we're going to work a deal here. We're going to bail out the private investors. Get them out of the picture here. You know, we're going to roll it over, pay them off, get them out of the picture. So all the debt now is government debt, virtually. So they protected, you know, the private bankers and the hedge funds and so forth. And most of the debt is government debt. You know, IMF debt, European Commission debt, so forth, ECB debt. that Greece is, trying to deal with. That could be easily restructured. There are virtually no private interests involved here. But they want their pound of flesh. They want the Greeks to keep paying the interest on the debt forever. Right? They don't want to, and we're talking about $300 billion, not a small amount for a small country like Greece, because they don't want the precedent. They don't want the example of any country that they overloaned money to that got into debt, simply wiping it out. They don't want to do that. Bad precedent, right? Plus, they want the labor market reforms. You see, if they Northern European and bankers cave in on labor market reforms, well, then what about the same reforms that they're trying to push in Italy and trying to push in France? I mean, it's a precedent. If they let Greece get away with it, then how are they going to enforce it on French workers, Italian workers? They know that, and that's why they're playing hardball with Greece. Well, my prediction is Greece is going to continue to negotiate and slowly back up, and there will be a deal that will avert a default at the end of June. But it will be a very unfavorable deal for Greece. And in the meantime, Greece's economy is getting worse, worse, worse. And then this thing will backfire, and the Greek people will realize what's happening here later this year, early next year. And I think the possibility of a Greek exit is also on the agenda in 2016. Right? You have to go through this whole process of default or avoiding default and paying the huge cost of that here this year in order to raise the possibility of a Greek exit. I don't see that Greece is preparing for an exit, however. There's some potential big costs for that. What Greece should do between now and next year is develop a parallel currency. They should return the drachma or some other currency and operate with both currencies, the euro and the new currency. And they should take certain actions to ensure that the new currency appreciates above the euro. And then they should say, okay, we're going to pay back you folks in Northern Europe that we owe you so many euros. We're going to pay it back in appreciated new currency. Take it or leave it. And if you don't like it, okay, well then you won't get anything paid back, and we will have a functioning currency as we exit the Eurozone. Greece has to do something like that. They have to create another currency in parallel. You don't leave the Eurozone. You don't leave the Euro. You stay in. You just develop a secondary currency in parallel to it. So there's no exit. In the first phase, there's no exit. And you pay off with inflated new currency, whatever we call it, drachmas or whatever, the old euro-based debt. Okay, so that's my view. But you got to take certain actions to make sure that the new currency is worth more than the old currency. Okay. There are ways of doing that, I think. What do the Greeks have to lose? I mean, they won't, the Europeans and Wolfgang Schäuble and all those other ministers, they're going to hold their feet to the fire. They're not going to give them any breaks. The Greeks aren't really prepared to take them on yet, but they got to get out of this mode of just making concession to concession. They got to start building some counter pressure after June 30th. Get the best deal you can, but after that, you better prepare for the next round, because it's going to come, because your economy is going to get worse, and people are going to then say, just this agreement, this deal is terrible, which they will. Okay, so we're going to see a Greek exit maybe 16, and definitely a British exit in 16. And we'll see what that means for the euro and the eurozone. It certainly won't mean sustained economic growth. Okay, next week we'll be back with another topic here. And I'm going to see if we can talk about Bernie Sanders and his announcement to run for president. We're going to get some people on here and discuss that. What does this all mean? Is it another co-optation or is it something else? Okay, Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.